think we'll go ahead and get started. I am Leslie Benjamori. I'm visiting here, actually, at LSE Ideas this year as a senior fellow, although I'm my day job is at SOAS, and I'm also associated with the Chatham, with the U.S. program at Chatham House. I see Jacob is here. Hello. I should apologize for being a few minutes late. I thought I was under the impression that we were an 8:30 start. That shows you that I am brand new. Although I am also a graduate of the LSE from, I think my master's here was 1991-92, so it's been a few years, but I like to come back every 4 or 5 years. It's a real honor to be here this morning to introduce to you Dr. Brian Claus and Gideon Rockman. Brian and I have enjoyed being on television a few times lately, so I understand what we're in for. And of course, I'm one of the people who wakes up every morning and logs into the FT first, actually, and looks to see what Gideon has said. And it doesn't always make the rest of the day a happy one, but it certainly makes it an interesting and engaging one. So it is an honor. I will give very brief introductions because it's the morning. And also because I'm guessing that most of you will know the work, certainly, of Gideon very well, and I would hope that you will learn the work of Brian very soon if you haven't followed it already. Dr. Claus will speak first for about 10 minutes. He is an LSE Fellow in Comparative Politics. He is an expert on global democracy, democratic transitions, American politics, Western foreign policy, political violence, and elections, has written extensively on these subjects, including his recent book, which I'm going to let you remind me the title of.
The Despot's Accomplice.
Despot's Accomplice, which I also need to read and look forward to reading soon. Gideon Rockman, as you know, is chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times. He's had a long and very, very distinguished career as a journalist. He began his career, I believe, with The Economist.
Even before that with the BBC, but
yeah. And even before that with the BBC. And most recently this summer wrote a book on Easternization, which I'm sure we will hear a bit about. And that was before we all knew where the world was heading. So things mattered even before November 8th and June 23rd. But with that, I will turn it over to you, Brian, and afterwards to you, Gideon.
Sure. Thank you very
much. I should also say this is Chatham House rules, so you can mention what's been said, but you cannot refer to anybody in particular who's said it. No affiliations, speakers.
Sure. Thank you very much for hosting me. It's a great pleasure to speak to you this morning. I assume in the Q&A we'll be talking a lot about Trump, and I will talk about Trump, but I'm going to broaden it out a bit to talk about how the crisis of democracy in the West is affecting the crisis of democracy everywhere else, to start. And so what my book is basically about is arguing how the West and Western foreign policy is undermining democracy in the rest of the world. And there's two, first off, the empirical side of things is that every year since 2006, the world has become less democratic than the year before. According to basically every political science index that tracks these things, it is a long-term trend and not one that started on November 8th, 2016, or June 23rd, if you are thinking about Brexit. But this long-term trend is one that I would argue will accelerate, and I'll explain why in a moment. But there's two major themes that I talk about in the book. One is the idea that the West has given up on democracy abroad. And the way I phrase this is the idea that the dictatorial devil we know is better than the democratic devil we don't. And this has, I think, its roots in 2003 in the Iraq conflict, but accelerated dramatically after the Arab Spring, the debacles in Libya, and also the turmoil in the Ukraine. And that's something that really struck me as I did field work around the world and would speak to ambassadors. And you would have Western ambassadors. When I went to Belarus, for example, the last dictatorship in Europe, you'd have an ambassador from a Western country saying, this is not Ukraine, this cannot become Ukraine. And so we're going to live with Lukashenko for as long as we need to. And I say, well, he's like 50 years old. How long are you going to be willing to live with him? And they say, as long as it takes, right? And this is something that's really striking when you get this from a country or a series of countries that purport to be in favor of promoting democracy abroad. And that has really pulled the rug out of a lot of opposition movements around the world who now realize that at least tacitly the West is in favor of the dictatorial devil they know. The second aspect of this, and this is, I think, is much more important in the sort of 130-plus countries you don't hear about on a daily basis, the ones that are not major players in Western foreign policy, is something I call the curse of low expectations. And this, in my very first field research trip to Madagascar many years ago, I interviewed the head of a political party, and they said to me, unlike the other parties, we're a party of values. And I said, okay, which values? and he got this deer in the headlights look and said, I forgot the values in the car. Can somebody go get the values for the American, please? And there was this moment where it was so clear that this charade was happening, where I was the Westerner playing the part of the sort of cop, and they were the person trying to impress me with their Democratic credentials. And I saw this as an election observer repeatedly, where you would have the election finish, and within hours it would be approved by the West, even though things had happened, like there had been no census since 1991, so half the country wasn't on the voter roll. And you call it free and fair, right? And the problem in places where this is the bar that the West sets for democracy is that the ruling elite, of which I've interviewed many people who have been presidents or former presidents, they say, you know, off the record, like, we got everything we wanted. We get the foreign aid. We got the legitimacy. Why is the next election going to change? Why would we ever do this, right? And it's a basic incentive. So those two aspects, I think, are ones that are very likely to accelerate under the presidency of Donald Trump, because he does not use the words human rights or democracy abroad ever. And notably, in his inauguration, he did not talk about the free peoples of the world or the democratic peoples of the world. He talked about the civilized peoples of the world. And this is part of what I would say in my book. I frame promoting democracy as three possible paths. There's basically the Chinese model, where you don't care whether a country is democrat or authoritarian, democratic or authoritarian. There's the current status quo that I would say pre-Trump is what the West did, which is to purport to support democracy and to genuinely support democracy when it doesn't conflict with geostrategic goals like economic growth or security, but to allow democracy to fall by the wayside when it does. And the third, which I support in my book, which is probably dead on arrival now, is to have a consistent long-term support for democracy abroad. I think Trump is going to behave much more like China on the global stage when it comes to democracy. I think he's signaling very clearly that he's a pragmatist, a deal maker, and that he's not going to worry too much about the domestic politics of countries that the United States is dealing with. And what I think is really damaging about that is it sends a very, very clear signal to the internal dynamics in all of these countries that you don't hear about on a daily basis, that if you work with the U.S. on security, for example, counterterrorism, which the Trump administration is making out to be a huge, huge part of its foreign policy, then crackdowns, torture, jailing of journalists, et cetera, won't be called out, right? And that, and already you're starting to see, even in the first 15 days, there is an increase in some of these measures in different countries that I study. And I'm going back to Thailand tonight, actually, and already there's a lot of reports that it's a very it's becoming a more grim place. There was talk about reviving the black ops sites, which is thankfully now appears to not be happening, but that's one of the things that Thailand did during the war on terror. So and at the same time, they're trying to diversify. Thailand, for example, is trying to diversify its relationships with Russia and China to ensure that it doesn't get pressed on democracy as much, and it knows that it won't anymore from the U.S., so it's free to branch out and make arms deals with Moscow much more. The final thing I'd like to highlight is something that I didn't think would happen in my life, which is that before I became an academic, I co-ran a campaign for governor in my home state of Minnesota. I worked in U.S. politics. When I became an academic, I started studying despots and authoritarian regimes. And bizarrely, those two worlds have now collided. And I did not think that I would be using the one expertise in the other. But it's very real. It's something where I would say that the last 15 days have looked like what the first 15 days of authoritarian backsliding would look like in the United States if it were to occur. And some aspects of Trump where you sort of, you take the lens a bit back and think about what's actually happening beyond the day-to-day noise of the tweets, there's a really troubling blurring of lines between truth and falsehood, which is extremely dangerous, especially in times of crisis. You can imagine what it would be like if you had something where say a few years ago where Putin says we don't have any troops in eastern Ukraine, Obama says yes you do, and nobody trusts Obama, right? No one believes him. And that's going to happen in Trump's presidency. It could be the South China Sea, it could be with Russia, we don't know. But there will be a moment where we need to trust the White House and we cannot. The second aspect, which is continuing today, or at least yesterday on Twitter, is attacking legitimate media for reporting the truth. There's a clear aspect of this that is aimed at basically making it even more difficult to understand who to trust. It denigrates the core of democracy, which is informed consent, because people don't know what to believe. And the final thing that I would suggest the Trump administration is already doing is, which I've seen done around the world, is using the rally around the flag effect with counterterrorism to erode rights. And I think that the immigration ban is the opening gambit of that, and I worry deeply about what will happen when an attack comes from within the United States and how that is used as a pretext to ramp up scapegoating of immigrants, which, by the way, is not just with Muslims, but also they're planning to release a biweekly or weekly report of crimes committed by immigrants in the United States. They also released 78 terrorist attacks that they said were not covered by the media extensively yesterday, including the San Bernardino attack, the Nice attack, the Paris Bataclan massacre. Turn on your TV for a week around those, and you couldn't see anything else. But I'll end with all of that dark stuff on a sort of hopeful note, which is that even in my social media echo chamber, personally, I'm seeing a reinvigoration and defense of democracy I've never seen in my life. And people who do not care about politics care about politics. And so the only hopeful silver lining here I can see is that if the sort of, you know, liberal forces, liberal, you know, in the sense of, you know, pro-democracy, human rights, et cetera, if those forces are able to beat back the Trump administration in the United States, it could actually be an extremely important reinvigoration and rescue of democracy at a time where it had been taken for granted for basically since the Cold War. And that's the only hope I have right now in these very dark times. So with that, I'll end my notes and my remarks and turn it over to Gideon.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. That was really interesting. Is this on? Yeah. I thought I'd pick up on the word decline of the West rather than the crisis of democracy bit that you focused on. And I mean, I think that one of the interesting things about the kind of new demagogues who are arriving in the West, and obviously Trump is leading the pack, is the way in which they've explicitly endorsed and embraced the idea of the West being in decline, which is very new, certainly in the United States, where it, you know, certainly post-Reagan, it was felt to be fatal for any politician to appear declinist. That was Jimmy Carter. Reagan's optimism was what was felt to have carried him to victory. Clinton was the boy from hope, etc., etc. And indeed, Hillary Clinton in the campaign attempted to say, we don't need to make America great again, it's already the greatest country on earth, which would normally be a winning slogan, but it didn't win. And instead you have Trump saying, we're in terminal decline, it's carnage, to use the word he used in the campaign, in his inaugural address. And this has now become quite a common playbook. You see it, obviously, with Marine Le Pen in France, the last chance to save France, France in terminal decline, attacked on all sides. And I must say, actually, it seemed to me that the French, I wouldn't embrace, obviously, Le Pen's narrative, but that there is more reason for a sense of crisis in France, actually, economically and because of the attacks that they suffered last year. But you see it also, you know, on a more minor scale with people like Viktor Orban in Hungary, where it's more about, he talks more about the West than about his own country, but about the idea that the West is a sick civilization, that we need to look east. And so this declinist narrative has become really key to the appeal, I think, of the new authoritarianism in the West. And to some extent, I wouldn't want to totally lump Brexit in with it, but there was also that sense in the campaign here that the country needed to look back to better times, that things had gone badly wrong, and we needed to take back control. So To what extent does the, why are these slogans resonating, I think, is an interesting question. Do they, in fact, reflect the reality that people feel around them? We've all taken more of an interest, you know, in the deindustrialization of the Midwest, of the north of England, since the votes for Trump and for Brexit. And I think that the bit that's clearly been happening, the bit that is less commented upon, actually, even in the in the narratives of the declinist politicians, is the extent to which this is part of a kind of big secular movement of wealth and power towards Asia, which I think has been happening for the last 40 years and more. It began really with the industrialization of Japan and then the tiger economies, South Korea's, the Southeast Asian nations, and then it becomes really a momentous global event with the opening of China in the late 70s and the double-digit growth we've seen of China. And by 2014, the IMF is saying that China is the world's largest economy, at least measured in terms of purchasing power. It's not yet there in terms of real exchange rates. In other respects, China already outweighs America. It's the world's largest exporter. It's the world's largest manufacturer. This is a very, very new sensation for people, for Americans and for people in the West. And I think the America-Chinese balance of economic power is reflected in the broader balance of economic power between the West and Asia. So that if you wonder, well, why are the Americans so exercised about the South China Sea? Why are the Chinese so exercised about it? Well, 29, I think, of the world's 40 busiest trading routes go through the South China Sea. I think Hillary Clinton said 50% of the world's merchandise trade goes through the South China Sea. To an extent, the center of the global economy now is Asia in a way that it used to be the Atlantic. And I think that, consciously or otherwise, that lies behind this sense of things are going wrong. A sense in the West that, well, we used to be, really for 500 years, the center of the world. The rest of the world had to respond and was shaped by what was happening in Europe and then in the United States. And we're just at the beginning of an era where we are beginning to feel, well, maybe we're now shaped by forces we don't control, that don't originate from the West, that they originate in Asia. And that is an uncomfortable feeling. And that, I think, is then reflected, actually, in, to some extent, in the thinking of Steve Bannon, this figure who, you know, people are now referring to as President Bannon, who appears to be a more influential, certainly a more intellectual figure than Trump, not hard, obviously, but who in one of his rare interventions, he gave an interview to a conference at the Vatican, actually, you can find on BuzzFeed. He said, what we have done, he denounced globalization. He said, what we've done is destroyed the middle class in the West and created a middle class in Asia. So he makes a direct connection between the economic problems of their core voters and the rise of Asia and the decision to open markets and globalization and all of that. And then that, I think, makes a intellectual link to the need for protectionism in his view. I think they really are intent, or at least he is intent, on taking apart the kind of global trading system or restructuring it very radically in an attempt to recreate a world in which the West is once again the sort of dominant economic power, which seems to me probably a mirage, but that's where they're going. And then I'd like to finish by just picking up on the same point that Brian talked about, this emphasis on civilizations, the civilized nations rather than the free nations or the democratic nations. And that, I think, consciously or not, was a sort of sleight of hand where you move from the West being identified with a set of core values to being identified with a culture or even perhaps a kind of racial, ethnic identification of the West. And that, to me, makes some sense of why this big mysterious question, why is Trump so friendly towards Russia? And we all know the conspiracy theories, which may well have something to them. But I think there's also a sense that, certainly again, if you look at the way Bannon talks about Russia, that Russia is part of the West in a sort of civilizational sense. It's a Christian country, it's a white country, it's fighting a war on Islam, which is really central to the thinking of both Bannon and Flynn. And therefore, it's part of us. And in a way, Merkel, who they are extremely hostile to, is a sort of traitor to the West because she has let in a million Muslims into Germany. And once you start thinking of the West in civilizational and racial terms, you kind of reimagine who your friends are and who your enemies might be. And then finally, associated with that, I think, and making this a rather dangerous moment, is a declining faith in democracy around the world. I mean, Brian talked about the declining faith in democracy promotion amongst the Western elites, but that seems to be reflected, perhaps for different reasons. I think there's quite strong polling evidence that people's belief that democracy is the best system is really falling quite sharply in the West. And I was actually just come back from South Africa and sat through a very interesting presentation on South African politics, and it's the same there, actually. The younger generation of people no longer believe that democracy, that it has to be a democratic system. The people who went through the struggle against apartheid still do. But for the young, they look around and they say, well, what's so great about this system? It hasn't delivered the things that we want. We still don't have jobs and so on. Which I think has a resonance to perhaps why there's a falling faith in democratic values in the West, is that most, there is a group of people, I'm sure many of them in this room, who see democracy as a value in itself. But then there's, I think, a larger group of people who see democracy as a system for producing results. And if they begin to be convinced, either through their own lived experiences or because of politicians' narratives, that actually democracy is not producing results, that it's betrayed them in some respects, they may be beginning to flirt with other systems of government. And so there is a connection between this theme of the decline of the West as a system for producing prosperity and security and a crisis of democracy.
Thank you. I think I'm going to begin with the first sort of question/comment and then open it up into the floor.